Gillian, thank you very much for that most interesting contribution. I think all of us here recognise the importance of international human rights law as the foundation of the practical human rights norms that we are all so concerned to see implemented. And it's fascinating to hear an academic of your standing speak in that way about the importance of international law. Can I just take up the issue that you mentioned towards the end of your presentation about us now needing in the 21st century to move on from the first 50 or 60 years of the United Nations work, which was concentrated more on establishing human rights norms, to the implementation of those norms. And that was central to the Secretary General's reform process of the United Nations, and it is the philosophy that's now underlying the work of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights in Geneva. When the United Nations Charter was created, no such thing as a national human rights institution existed. NGOs have recognition in the United Nations Charter. National human rights institutions do not. They didn't really become an entity of any significance until the early 1990s, and the Paris Principles, of course, were approved by the General Assembly in 1993, which are the principles which determine whether an institution, a national institution, is sufficiently independent of government to be recognised as a national human rights institution in the UN system. In the days of the Human Rights Commission, national institutions were barely recognised because they were not reflected at all in the United Nations Charter. Australia and India led the charge to get recognition for national institutions and made some progress at long last on that in 2006, when there was a resolution passed by the Human Rights Commission to recognise the status of national institutions. Then, of course, the Commission ceased to exist and the Council came into being. Fortunately, in 2007, national institutions were recognised in the rules of the new Human Rights Council and are now recognised as participants in the system. The Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights has promoted the view that the national institutions are bodies that should be used as the conduit between the United Nations standard-setting mechanism and the implementation of human rights at a national and grassroots level. So there is an increasing recognition of the role of national institutions and their status. And that has fortunately at long last carried through into the treaty bodies, which now recognise that the national institutions have a right to participate in their work. I mentioned the Commission for the Status of Women. Unfortunately, that is a subcommittee of the ECOSOC, whereas the Human Rights Council is a subcommittee of the General Assembly, and the enthusiasm for recognising the position of national institutions in the Human Rights Council and its subsidiary bodies, and the treaty bodies, is not recognised by the Commission for the Status of Women. In that commission, national institutions still have no formal recognition. Pursuant to the Paris Principles, national institutions should not be there as representatives of the state government. On the other hand, they can't be there as NGOs, so they are left in limbo. So, Mr. Attorney, there's an area there where I think the states need to bring about some change of rules to give national institutions an independent status. Can I just mention that because of this new role of national institutions and the fact that they are entitled to speak on any issue on the Human Rights Council, there's a whole new area of responsibility and administrative responsibility opening up. National institutions now have to keep an eye on what's going on in Geneva. The Human Rights Council is a body that sits several times a year and is sitting in emergency sessions also, so it's almost constant movement there. Somehow or other, national institutions have to be kept abreast of what's happening and need to have a presence in Geneva to be able to participate when the need arises. This means that an old body called the International Coordinating Committee of National Human Rights Institutions, which has really been a completely ineffective grouping over the years, has suddenly assumed new importance, and steps are underway presently to have that body incorporated, for it to have a presence in Geneva. It will have a permanent representative in Geneva, and that representative will report to national institutions around the world and speak for them as and when necessary. So national institutions are going to take a much more active role in the United Nations human rights mechanism than it has in the past. And I just thought I'd pass that on to you. Well, I'll just say a word or two about the Pacific, and I don't want to cut question times down, and I know the attorney has to leave us at 10 to 2. But the Pacific is an area where there is great concern in the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights that there's been quite an adequate take-up of international human rights conventions. If you leave aside Australia and New Zealand, each of which have signed, I think, 6 of the 7 major human rights conventions, very few of the Pacific states have signed more than 1 or 2. And there is some considerable resistance to the notion of human rights there. Some people saying, well, look, that international human rights are inconsistent with custom, or alternatively, why are we worried about it? We don't seem to have a problem here, and we haven't got the economic base to enable us to accept reporting obligations and so on. The Office of the High Commissioner has set up a regional office in Fiji, and it has another regional office in Bangkok, and is putting a lot of effort into encouraging the Pacific states to sign up to the conventions and to look at establishing some international human rights mechanisms in the Pacific. Obviously, it's important that those things happen, but it just seems to me that there's another dimension up there which the Office of the High Commissioner tends to overlook. The Pacific states each have constitutions. They each have very good sets of entrenched human rights within those constitutions, and the constitutions provide mechanisms for judicial remedy for the breach of them. The reality is that those rights are not accessed or enforced, not taken up. I think the reason they're not taken up is people don't understand them, and there is just a lack of process access. There are not sufficient lawyers, there's not sufficient understanding, there's not sufficient legal aid. Even if people are aware of these rights, they're something in the ether that they haven't got access to. It seems to me that Australia, and particularly HERIOC, can exercise very important educative roles in the Pacific and should be seen to be doing so. And I think that we've got to start working more at the grassroots level and concentrating exclusively on the upper echelons of government. And HERIOC, in conjunction with the Asia Pacific Forum, are at the moment looking at ways in which, at a practical level, we can perhaps work with NGOs, civil society, and I think especially women's groups on matters of domestic violence, organisations which are concerned with disability issues, because I think there is some movement in the Pacific states to look at signing up to the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, and work at a very practical level trying to build capacity. And I would really like to think that HERIOC and the Asia Pacific Forum, with some support from the Australian government, will have the capacity and the facilities to do that. So I just mentioned those things also. Ladies and gentlemen, we've reached the end of the formal presentations, but I think both speakers are happy to receive some questions, and it's obviously an extraordinarily important area. So I would invite contributions or participation questions from the floor, if there are any. Yes.
Thank you very much, Attorney, and Professor Triggs, for coming to speak to us. And I'd like to commend the Rudd government on their commitment to a consultation on a Charter of Rights. But just drawing on something that Professor Triggs has said about the importance of economic, social and cultural rights, I'm keen to hear whether, and in sort of the context of Australia's engagement with international human rights mechanisms, including the ICESCA Convention, I'm keen to hear whether the government is going to include in their terms of reference or whatever for the Charter economic, social and cultural rights.
Thanks for that. The inquiry will look at two things. It will look at those views, the views of the Australian people as to what rights they think are fundamental and should be protected. And we're expecting, of course, not only local citizens along the lines of the Bush Talks program that was conducted a few years ago, but academics, government institutions and universities and so forth to put in submissions along those lines as to just what rights should be included. Then we will be looking at what mechanisms are needed to ensure those rights are protected. So to answer your question directly, that's open for consideration as to what should be there.
Yes. Simon Wright.
Thank you, Tony. Just following that up, you asked before the rhetorical questions of about a government that would, a 21st century democratic government, not wishing to be held account for its international human rights performance. And I agree with the implicit criticism in that. And so asking that same question from outside, looking into Australia, it does highlight the absence in Australia of a government volunteering to hold itself accountable to human rights, hence our debate about the Charter. The emerging Australian model, such as it is, sadly is a fairly modest approach to rights in the ACT in Victoria, where it doesn't go any further than the government volunteering to comply with human rights. It's about as far as it goes. So if we take that as probably the level at which the debate in Australia is pitched, I wonder why then the federal government needs to consult. I don't know, I don't understand the position the government takes if it balks at volunteering to hold itself accountable to international human rights standards, and if it balks at even the Australian model, which is an unenforceable protocol, if you like, for human rights compliance. And I wonder whether it's because the government generally is determinedly neutral about whether or not Australia should declare its willingness to comply with human rights, or whether perhaps the government does want to do it but for political reasons feels that it has to go through this process, or whether perhaps the government rather not, and the process is a way of avoiding it. To ask the Australian people what human rights should we comply with when everyone else in the world has acknowledged a standard set of human rights, and to ask the Australian people what mechanisms we should adopt when there is literally a world of examples for us to follow, really does make me wonder why the rhetorical question won't continue to be asked of Australia when it would be a reasonably straightforward step to volunteer to comply with human rights. Why the process?
I should say the government has no hesitation in saying that we should comply with human rights. When we sign up to a treaty, we ensure that the laws, the Australian laws, state, territory, federal, are in accordance with those. We expect our public servants to comply with their rights in the implementation of it. And indeed, there is High Court authority to the effect that any law as passed shall, unless the language makes it impossible to so construe it, should be construed consistently with the international human rights obligations that Australia signed up to. In addition, I should say that I have prepared a letter to ministerial colleagues seeking their views on formal mechanisms to ensure that Australia's human rights obligations are considered at the point of drafting rather than in the sort of scrutiny of bills process, as cursory as that is, after legislation has been tabled and introduced. In terms of the inquiry, getting views on both what rights should be entrusted in a charter, which won't of course detract from the fact that we've already a signatory to a range of rights. Indeed, the fact that we are a signatory to international human rights obligations is a foundation of this very commission that we're being invited to participate in today. But in terms of the format, as to whether you have a legislative charter, whether there is an entrenched charter, whether the extent to which the judiciary has an influence in it, these, with respect, I'd suggest are not without some complexity, certainly not without some controversy, and I think it's better all round that there is a dialogue on those things. I think it's also useful to have a dialogue from the point of view of those who, as you've seen, are passionately opposed to a Bill of Rights, so that they so that they see it's not about overturning
the customs or their principles that they hold dear. It's about and I would say specifically that there's one or two church leaders who I think if you said to them as decent people as I'm sure they are, look, do you recognise that human beings have fundamental human rights? Indeed, the American Bill of Rights refers to God-given rights, and I think the United Kingdom Bills of Rights similarly refer to the God-given rights that all citizens have. And I think they would say, yes, human beings have fundamental human rights, and I think if the dialogue brings this out, the consultation process brings this out so that people are of a consensus, yes, human beings have fundamental human rights, then you simply move into the next phase. Well, how are those rights recognised? And that is the topic for legitimate debate, certainly consultation.
Dean, were you wanting to add something?
Could I just say, Simon, in further answer to that question, but in New Zealand they embarked upon a wide-ranging community consultation process to design their Human Rights National Action Plan, and it was thought that the educative value of going around for community consultations and getting people to understand what the debate was about was extremely important in itself, and this same process would occur, I think, with what's envisaged by the government.
Yeah, Chris Sadoki did a good thing a few years back with the Bush Talks program, which I think is still on the website.
Yes.
That was also a good example of the educative effect that consultation can have.
Thank you. Now there was a question. Yes.
I was really pleased to hear that you and your portfolio. I don't need it. Thanks. want to look at the development of more legislation from a human rights framework. And I'm particularly interested in what kind of previous or current or future involvement your portfolio will have in the development of new workplace relations, because thus far we've heard that right of entry laws, for example, will not change. And Harriok has made submissions to the Senate and in general about the effect of right of entry laws on the right to organise and collectively bargain, and in particular disadvantaged employees, outworkers, etc. I'm hoping that in an examination and genuine consideration of international treaties and conventions such as the right to organise and collectively bargain, that position will change. Can you comment on that?
The role of the Attorney General's Department has proposed or will be proposed to ministers is that we provide guidance as to when legislation potentially offends or butts up against or should recognise human rights instruments, obviously to set out those key instruments and to provide guidelines, and also to offer advice, not from me as the Attorney General, but more so experts within the department, that is the Attorney General's department, should another government department require or think it desirable to obtain that advice as to how amendments should be made to make the legislation consistent with those obligations. But if I could say in respect to workplace relations, Julia Gillard is highly competent and highly principled. She was no slouch as a highly competent industrial lawyer herself. I have matters against her. She was very good. She will get the right outcome.
That would surely mean that right of entry laws will change.
Look, there will be overall reform, but let Julia catch your eyes.
Take it as a question, Dan.
Thanks for speaking. Tony, I was just wondering if you could clarify, please, the position of the government in regards to the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples. It's been very difficult to find out what the government's commitment to the Declaration of Peoples.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. We are committed to it. Jenny Macklin has made those statements. We are committed. It's a, as I understand it, Professor Triggs can clarify it, but it's not an instrument that we ratify, but rather acknowledge and adhere to, and the government is determined to do that. and we are consulting with the states and territories about doing that now. But we're clearly on the record as saying that's an important instrument. We think the rhetoric against us, that it is in some way going to result in people using their backyards to native title claimants, is rubbish. Equally, we say that the recognition of Aboriginal customary law as overriding Australian criminal law is also rubbish. These are aspirational principles that we find no difficulty in supporting, and we're liaising with the states about doing that.
Tim?
Yes.
I'd too like to thank my speakers and say that I'm particularly excited about the changing atmosphere we've got in this country in terms of our country and policy. But without wishing to sound too dry, and listen with disabilities involved in that sector, I'm very interested to know, Attorney, about what's happening about the review process, the access to premises, which I understand been sitting on the desk of your predecessor since 2004. I don't know how well you cleaned out the desk of Blair, but I'm interested whether there is any plans to address this, because we with disability would like to all be able to come hold and worry about the impediments that this might open up.
I've got a staff member at the back there, but we issued a discussion document, a white paper, and I think the commentaries were acquired by the end of May, is that right?
Yeah,
I think we're keen on getting an outcome by an anniversary date in October, I think, is in respect to these. But there's a process of consultation going through now, and perhaps Graham might. Do you want to say a few things on that process, Graham?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, thanks. I don't think the government has issued a discussion document, but there is, as Leighton says, a working group which the Commission's been part of, advising you and the Minister for... I'm sorry, I can't remember the...
Innovation.
Yes, Innovation, thank you. Minister for Innovation. And as you say, that's close to completing its work, and that should come before government in the next... month or two, I would have guessed.
Thank you. And there is a document in respect to transport standards.
That's true. That's right.
That's
yes.
The one I was thinking.
Yeah.
About.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, any other contributions? Yes.
Sorry, Attorney. In terms of your words about rule of law, which is the most wonderful music to a lawyer's ears, I have to say, and also your comments about anyone held in protection being treated with decency. I just wonder if you could reiterate the Rudd government's views on Guantanamo Bay and what's been done to put those views into action.
Yeah, sure. It's pretty well the position of the British government. We have clearly stated we are opposed to Guantanamo Bay. We think that Guantanamo Bay should be closed. There is an issue as to what should happen to the people there. The United States government are saying, if this is going to be closed, there are some people there that I think there is a consensus do present a risk, and requiring assistance of the international community as to what happens. Obviously, we think they... where offences are relevant, they should be returned to their countries of origin. But we think that Guantanamo Bay should be closed, and we we have that view has been publicly stated and communicated.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think we must bring this to a close. I know the attorney has another commitment. It is now 10 to 2. May I thank you both, Attorney Professor Triggs, for a most enlightening seminar. I think all of us will go away greatly encouraged by what we've heard. Thank you very much. Would you please join me in thanking you?